Thank you for listening to the Faith Radio Mornings podcast. Enjoy the conversation.
Start your day connecting faith to life with Faith Radio Mornings.
Let it rise.
Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour. Welcome to Friday. Bill Arnold here. All right. British Prime Minister Theresa May is getting calls to resign. So she is busy assembling a coalition government. I guess they call that horse trading, where you gather up smaller parties and you try to get them into your coalition. Sounds like it would actually be more fun to just do real horse trading. I will trade you Bucky for Mariah. There we go. But we're going to ask British foreign affairs expert David Aikman in the second hour to weigh in on what's going on over there. James Comey, of course, he leaked an email. I don't know. Was that wise? Did he find himself on the wrong side of the law? We will ask John Malcolm in this hour. He's vice president for the Institute for Constitutional Government, graduate of Harvard Law. Looking forward to hearing what he has to say. And he says, though, Comey says the White House was spreading lies. About what? About the American public maybe had lost faith in the FBI? Because they have. So we'll find out exactly what that is all about. And Comey was grilled by Senator John McCain. And the happiest part for me watching that exchange was when I heard these words, "The senator's time has expired." Then I got happy. So North Korea tested a new missile, which could reach the U.S. I guess they're continuing to try to get to us, but we will not let that happen. And the Pittsburgh Penguins took a game lead. Now it's 3-2 in the Stanley Cup. And my Minnesota Twins won 2-1 last night, beating the Seattle Mariners. But the folks in Madison and Sioux Falls and Hartford probably don't care. But that doesn't mean I still don't care about you, because I do. I love you guys. All right. And the word of the day is squinty. Squinty is to look or peer with eyes partly closed, which is, I think, what most of us are doing this morning. We are looking with squinty. All right. That's how we start our day. Anyway, we got a great leadoff hitter in today's show. How about this? Pastor Jason Meyer from Bethlehem Baptist. We're going to talk about what it's like to talk about sin in today's world. He is going to weigh in on that in just a minute. We'll be back with Jason Meyer. Welcome and good morning. Bill Arnold here. You know, LeBron James the other day said, after game three, I think, of the NBA Finals, he was saying, "This is probably the most firepower I have played against in my career." And right now I have in the studio maybe some of the most firepower I have talked to. And that, of course, is Jason Meyer, pastor for Preaching and Vision at Bethlehem here in Minneapolis. Jason, welcome back to the show.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
And there is some firepower across the studio here with me. I just a big fan. And what I really want to talk to you about today is the problem that we have and how complicated it is in today's culture, talking about the problem of sin.
It's a huge problem because a lot of people don't relate anymore to standards that are external to them. They relate to themselves as kind of the standard of reference. And so to try to convince them that they're, for example, in the past, sin is breaking the law of God, lawlessness. To them, you immediately get into a conversation about relativism. Well, so what? Mm-hmm. How do you know that that's what's really judging me?
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes incredibly difficult.
But we're dealing with people who are lost and unregenerated, so they really would have no clue to start with. So the whole idea of sin is just something completely, utterly foreign.
It's totally foreign. And so you got to give them categories. There's a lot of pre-evangelism that has to happen in terms of, for example, you can let them know, well, you have standards, and do you ever live up to your own standards? So at that point, they have a category for falling short of a standard, and then it's a short step to say, if there is a God, then I think you can imagine that his standards are even higher than yours,
mm-hmm.
purer, greater. And so you begin to build categories even to be able to communicate.
Mm-hmm. Don't we fear persecution, though? We don't want people not to like us, but it's a sin not to talk about sin, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we need to have categories as Christians for the kind of response that we're going to get. Because in the past, it would be a conversation about truth. You could talk to somebody and you'd be sharing the gospel with them, and they would want to argue back about why that's not true. Now, it seems like people want to argue back to say, that's hate. What you're saying about me is condemning. What you're saying about me is like a hate crime. And so what you have to do back is to be able to say, in our age of tolerance, I always say, it sounds like you're disagreeing with me. Why doesn't that make you intolerant? And then they'll come back usually by saying, yeah, okay, but your intolerance is worse because you think I'm going to hell if I'm wrong. Mm-hmm. I just think you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then my response is typically, well, actually, we're just being consistent with our intolerance. All that you have is no personal God, and therefore all I'm answerable to is your wrath, your anger, if you think I'm wrong. But I believe in a personal God of judgment who rules the world, and therefore you're not answerable to my anger. I have no anger towards you or wrath. It's him.
Right.
And therefore, if he is an eternal God and is holding you responsible for this, then there is this category called hell. So we're just being consistent with our views, and we're both consistently intolerant.
Right. Now, aren't human beings basically incapable of accepting themselves exactly who they are and where they are? I mean, we're always like, oh, I'm not that bad of a person.
Yeah.
You know, so don't tag the sin on me, because that's your world and the world you live in. I am a pretty good guy. I give to the United Way. I help my neighbor shovel her walk, so back off.
Mm-hmm. I think you have to give them the category that says, I don't just occasionally do bad things.
Mm-hmm.
I do bad things because I am bad.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about me. So typically, I'll use the example of myself, and I'll say, don't just look at the occasional things you do. Look at the reactions of the heart and see, when you're crossed, do you typically respond with making the world around you better, or do you instinctively respond in harmful ways? So I give the example of driving along in my car. My wife is with me. We're driving together. I'm just going to make a lane change. I don't happen to look at who's next
right.
to me. And she says, she's in the car.
Yeah.
My first response, you would hope would be, oh, thank you for
thank
saving
you,
our life.
Yes.
But my first response is, I know.
Yeah.
And then after a while, I say, yeah, I didn't really know that. And she says, I know that. But there's this defensiveness. There's this ingrained protectiveness that I have that comes out.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we respond out of who we are. And so a lot of people want to say, well, the problem is my circumstances. It's what's ever around me. So Paul Tripp gives the example of a water bottle. If you take the cap off and shake it all around,
mm-hmm.
and it's going to leave water on the floor, you would say, well, why is all this water on the floor? Some people would answer, oh, it's because you shook the bottle. No, it's because there's water in the bottle. That's why there's water on the floor.
Mm-hmm.
It's what's in here. Yeah, circumstances might actually cause to come out
mm-hmm.
what's really there. But what's really there is you.
Yeah.
What's coming out is a picture of you.
Yes. Now, don't we all think that there's something kind of wrong with us instinctively? Don't we kind of go, yeah, I got my issues. I got problems. I mean, isn't that just how we're wired?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, didn't we? I think we talked about this last week with Glenn Pickering. He said, you go back to Genesis 3 when Satan shows up and says, there's something wrong with you.
Mm-hmm.
And we've believed it ever since.
Yeah. Yeah. The problem is there's a minimization of it. So we're willing to go so far and say, there's something wrong with us, but we never really put it into a context of, well, against who?
Mm-hmm.
And what's the hope in acknowledging that? I always tell people, if we're instinctively able to see there's something wrong, what do we do with it? We tend to deny it or minimize it rather than saying, okay, if I deny this, there's no hope. because there's no hope for denial of sin, only repentance of sin. That's where forgiveness comes from.
Mm-hmm.
Not denying sin, but actually confessing it and receiving forgiveness.
Mm-hmm.
So it's whatever we do with that acknowledgement.
How do we talk about sin when we're spending so much of our energy denying it in our culture?
I think we have to give people concrete categories for what it is. And the issue is that we tend to think about things only as they relate to us. And then because we have this kind of ingrained idolatry, we make sacrifices to our idols and we end up justifying them and minimizing them.
Mm-hmm.
So if you notice in the Bible, what happens is when King David has committed egregious sin and is justifying it.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a literal translation where he says to Nathan, or he says to Joab, don't let this thing be displeasing in your sight. And the very next verse says, but what David had done was displeasing in the sight of God.
Mm-hmm.
So he was instinctively minimizing this and saying, yeah, don't be bothered by this. And then what's the way that Nathan gets through to him? Nathan the prophet comes and he tells him a story in which, you know, David was a shepherd. He tells
mm-hmm.
him about a rich man that had lots of sheep,
mm-hmm.
but he stole the poor man's sheep in order to have a feast and says, what should be done about this? And David has this judicial sentiment that rises up and he says, well, that man deserves to die. And then Nathan simply says, story about you.
Ooh, yeah.
You're the man.
Yeah.
So oftentimes, I find it's very effective to take someone's judicial sentiment.
Mm-hmm.
We really feel wronged.
Right.
When we're wronged.
Right.
We feel that instinctively and deeply, and sometimes all you need to do is tell a story or a situation, let people's own judicial sentiment rise up and say, don't you do the same thing?
Mm. Will they be honest, though? That's the big question. We'll address that when we return. I'm talking to Jason Meyer, pastor of teaching at Bethlehem. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back. I've got Jason Meyer in studio, which makes me very happy. He's pastor for preaching and vision at Bethlehem Baptist and here in Minneapolis. And I am always anxious to talk to him and get his perspective because he goes right to the Bible, which is I always appreciate. We're talking today about sin and how we're having a difficult time discussing it. And we're in this culture, we're often reluctant to call it what it is, which is sin. And it's important that as Christians that we stay consistent in our witness because we always race to this idea that, well, we're not perfect and there's hypocrites everywhere. So if that's the case, it's a zero-sum game all of a sudden. So it's important that we are consistent in our witness. And Jason, I'd like you to speak to that, how important it is as believers and followers of Jesus to be consistent.
Well, it's absolutely essential that we're consistent in the right things, because people are going to hold us to our claims. Whatever we're claiming to be, they're going to hold us to it, and they should. The Bible says that we are supposed to set apart Jesus in our hearts as holy and always be ready to give an answer to those who ask a reason for the hope that's in us. So they're going to see something's different. Like Adrian Rogers said, nobody is going to look at us and ask what's going on if we can be explained. We have no right to be believed if we can be explained in natural categories, because what we claim is that something supernatural has absolutely intervened in our lives so that we're different, we're changed,
mm-hmm.
we can no longer be the same. So consistency there is really important, but is it a consistency of obedience where people can look at us and say, well, there's no longer any failure, any fault, you're always perfect now? All that we claim is not, people I think sometimes mistake this. They think that spiritual maturity is the same as physical maturity. that somehow physical maturity is you get better and better in terms of growing in being independent from your parents because you're able to handle responsibility and get better at life. But actually, spiritual maturity is not you get better and better so that you need Jesus less and less. Actually, you're growing in dependence upon your Heavenly Father. And your claim at that point is, look, like the Bible says, we all stumble in many ways. The difference is my hope is not based on my obedience. I am full of sin, but Christ is more full of grace, and He is my only hope. He's the only one that I'm leaning on. He's the only one that I'm hoping in. And so, yes, we have categories for sin, but the difference is we hate our sin, and we run to the cross with it, and we celebrate forgiveness. Those are the categories that we're working with, because a lot of other people are working with a category of being for themselves and independent and on their own, and we just confess, I need God more than I can put into words. John Newton said, I remember these two things only at the end of my life. One, I'm a great sinner. Two, I have a greater Savior.
Yeah. The sin of autonomy has to be at the top of the heap, isn't it? Don't we just simply want to do things our way? When we want to, how we want to?
And absolutely.
We really don't want to be accountable. And there was also a great author. He said that the most significant thing in my life is my accountability to God. So there we go, wanting autonomy, but really as we grow in our relationship, we need to be more dependent.
The Psalms present this picture of God as the judge, the one who stands over all the earth and will bring judgment. And we have the picture of we want to hold the scepter, which only belongs to Him. We don't want to kiss the scepter. We want to hold it. And what we don't realize is we think we're holding a scepter. We're really holding a lightning rod for the storm of judgment that's coming as we lift it high in the air in our autonomy and independence, and don't realize that what Jesus came to do was to take all of those lightning rods out of our hand and bring them up to Mount Calvary and bear the wrath of God for us, that the lightning strike of God's wrath could strike there, and we would now be free to just belong to Him because our sins are forgiven and we don't want to be independent anymore. I mean, when you get married, suddenly you want boundaries. You say, this is precious. I want to protect this. I don't want to go off on my own. I don't want to leave that which is my joy. In the same way we say about God, I want boundaries. I want to belong to Him. I'm not going to run away from that which is my only good.
Do we feel a sense of urgency to reach the lost?
See, I think that is a prime indicator of our spiritual health. Is whether or not, number one, we have a category that rises up in our hearts to say, I am somebody that's received mercy. I was starving, and I found this feast. And it's like in the Old Testament where the two beggars go out, and they find that the Syrians have gone. They've left this whole, all their provisions. They go out, and they start feasting, and then they say, we are doing wrong. We're sinning. This is a great day of deliverance, and here we are only partaking ourselves. We need to go tell everybody that's been under siege about this feast.
Wow, that's great. Jason, I love having you in studio. Next time you come back, would you try to be interesting?
I'll try.
I've been talking to Jason Meyer. He is the pastor of Preaching and Vision at Bethlehem Baptist in Minneapolis. I would have him on 5 days a week if I could. Thanks so much for being on the program, and we'll take a short break and be right back. Good morning, half past the hour. After news, I'm going to talk to John Malcolm from the Heritage Foundation. He's a legal expert. He went to Harvard Law. I suppose he can do better than that. And he is the vice president for the Institute for Constitutional Government. We're going to ask him about the James Comey Cirque de Comey, I call it. Be back in a minute. Good morning. You know, joy is not external, although we do like our stuff, don't we? Many people do look to external things and stuff to produce their joy. It's a common temptation, but speaker and author Kay Warren explains that true joy goes beyond your possessions and circumstances.
Joy actually has nothing to do with the externals. Everything that happens to us can be lost or changed or broken. The people that we care about can die or leave us. The position that we have at work can change or be given to somebody else. The possessions that we have can be, you know, destroyed, or they get old, or they break. Our personalities certainly aren't enough. And, you know, before long, all the things that we've put our very fragile hopes for joy in can shift and change around us. And because it is such a fragile thing, joy is, it can't be in those externals because they can be lost. And it has to be in something or someone that doesn't change or shift, will never leave us, who will never forsake us, never change, and that leaves us with God. God is the only source of joy that cannot be taken, cannot change, cannot leave us, will not abandon us, and therefore I can choose to trust in that unchangeable God. And when I do, then joy is something that occurs in my soul.
If you want to hear that full interview, you can go to myfaithradio.com, search Choosing Joy. That will take you to the Kay Warren interview on Choosing Joy. Be back in just a minute with John Malcolm.
Not everyone writes bestsellers, or any books at all for that matter. But words do matter, and your words matter. This is Jim Garlow. My dad was a Kansas farmer and a prolific author. When he died at age 82, he left behind 47 notebooks about his walk with God. Although he was never published, my son, his grandson, read them. He told me at one point, "I'm up to my ninth notebook." You may not write for the world, but if you want to influence your world, your sphere of influence, pick up the pen or sit at the keyboard or encourage those who do. The written word is like a baton. You are in a relay race. It doesn't make any difference how fast you run the race if you drop the baton. Get that baton from the person who's handing it to you into the hands of the next generation. There's more at jimgarlow.com. We'll do our part, keeping you informed at jimgarlow.com.
This is a Love Language Minute with Dr. Gary Chapman. A listener writes, "Gary, after 7 years, my girlfriend and I decided to take a break. I miss her dearly. Her love language is quality time. How can I speak that if I don't see her anymore?"
I could suggest, I guess, that you go to a common website. You read the website, an article on whatever topic, and then discuss it by email or by texting or maybe even by phone. My question would be, after 7 years of dating, you should be ready to make a decision, yay or nay, about this relationship. Sounds like she's made the decision, nay. And you're having difficulty with it. And that's understandable, because when you've dated someone for a long time, you will miss them. It's a part of the process of dating and then breaking up.
Dr. Gary Chapman is the author of The Five Love Languages. For more answers, visit startmarriageright.com.
Good morning, Bill Arnold here, almost 20 minutes until the top of the hour. John Malcolm is the Vice President for the Institute for Congressional Government. Went to Harvard Law School. First time I spoke to him, he made me nervous. But the good news for me is, since we last spoke, nothing has changed. John, welcome to the show.
It's good to be with you. It's actually Institute for Constitutional Government, so I'm already starting out making you nervous.
You see what I mean? I can't get away from this. First time you made me nervous, now I'm more nervous. So thank you.
Oh, my gosh. My pleasure. Good to be with you. Hopefully I'll calm you down over the course of our
please
conversation.
Please do. It's your responsibility to calm the host down, so please do your job this morning, okay?
I'll do my best.
All right. John, a couple things I want to ask you. First of all, thanks for coming on the program. I know you're a busy guy. Sure. But I do want to find out the Cirque de Comey that was happening yesterday, especially when John McCain was talking to him. It was unbelievable, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, that was not Senator McCain's finest moment. I looked up later what he was saying about it. You realize he actually had a response to this.
I know he did.
He said, he did. Oh, I was up late the night before watching the Diamondbacks games. Like, Senator, get a good night's sleep next time.
Right. My favorite part was when I heard the senator's time has expired. I thought, oh, what a relief. Anyway, let's talk seriously, though, if we can, about the hearings and what we've learned so far, and what questions should we still be asking?
Well, look, it was a very interesting hearing. I haven't seen so much hype about anything in Washington in quite a while. It really was like Comey mania. And I would say that there were points that he made for everybody. So let's talk about the things that the president would be happy about. So Jim Comey made it very clear that he had told the president on several occasions that he was not the subject or target of any kind of an investigation, although Donald Trump clearly wanted Comey to announce that, and he wouldn't do it. Comey also said that he considered the Flynn investigation separate from the Russian investigation, and that nobody, either the president or anybody in the intelligence community, ever spoke to him about the Russian investigation or tried to pressure him with respect to the Russian investigation. He said that after the Oval Office meeting, which was a bad point for the president, that the president never followed up and said, did you drop that Flynn matter, and never brought up Michael Flynn again. And in fact, in a conversation that took place a month and a half after that Oval Office meeting, he said, look, I want you to go public with the fact that I'm not under investigation, but if any of my quote-unquote satellite associates did anything wrong, I want you to find that out. And of course, the other things that the president would be pleased about is that Jim Comey dinged up Loretta Lynch pretty badly by saying he was confused and concerned by the way she was acting with respect to the Hillary Clinton server investigation, insisting that he use the word matter rather than investigation before Congress. Matter was the phrase that was being used by the Clinton campaign. And I suppose the president would be pleased about, and he's already tweeted about this, the fact that Jim Comey outed himself as having leaked through a friend at Columbia Law School a memo of his conversations to the New York Times. Now, if you were the president, you would not be happy about the fact that Jim Comey said, I didn't trust this guy. For the first time in my career, I started writing memos of my meetings and conversations with him because I thought there was a distinct possibility that he might lie about those conversations at some point in the future. With respect to that Oval Office conversation that happened to take place on Valentine's Day, he said the president excused everybody from the room, which made me very uncomfortable. I got the impression that Jeff Sessions and Jared Kushner, they lingered around because they didn't want to leave. They thought something untoward might happen. And that during that meeting, even though he had told me before that my job was secure, I felt like it was a job interview. He was demanding loyalty from me, and he was saying, I think it would be a really good idea, or I'm hoping that you'll drop this Flynn matter, which he took as direction that he wanted him to drop the Flynn matter. He later accused he said that I got fired and because of the Russian investigation, and he also said he accused the president of having defamed him after he was dismissed, saying that questioning his competency and leadership were just plain lies. And he also said that during this Oval Office meeting that he thought the president was looking to get something out of him in exchange for his keeping his job. So there were certainly political points that both sides could latch on to say, you see, this is our side of the version. Our version of the facts is true. And, of course, then they had a meeting behind closed doors talking about classified information. Probably the best stuff came out during that meeting.
Mm-hmm. John, whose turn is it to hate James Comey the most right now?
I'd say it's the Republicans are up at that, would be my guess.
I'm real curious how this falls on your legal ears when you hear that Loretta Lynch told Comey to call it a matter instead of an investigation. And where did she get that order? Did that come from the president?
Well, I don't know who it came from. I mean, Comey said that what concerned me is that that's how the Clinton campaign was referring to it. So I think his concerns were that the Obama administration, and quite possibly her, being from New York, where Hillary Clinton was from, were in the tank for Hillary Clinton. He said that that was one of the reasons why I decided I needed to separate myself from the Department of Justice, a very strange thing to say since the FBI is within the Department of Justice, and one could certainly question everything that Comey did after that in terms of his going public and making the statements that he made. But he clearly felt he needed to distance himself from Loretta Lynch, and that troubled him.
Yeah. When Loretta Lynch wanted it to be called a matter, did that slip out in conversation when Bill Clinton was talking to her on her plane that day about grandkids and golf?
I don't know. I mean, it was a very, very long conversation. You know, look, I don't have any grandkids yet. I love my kids.
Uh-huh.
I think the 45 minutes on the tarmac in a plane to be talking about my kids and golf would be a little bit much. But, you know, I wasn't a fly on the wall. I would have liked to have been.
Yeah.
So, yeah, we'll never know what was said.
Any surprises yesterday from your standpoint?
Yeah, I thought that Comey was certainly about Comey being the source of a leak of a memo was a little bit a little unusual. I hadn't heard anything about the Loretta Lynch stuff. That was certainly surprising. And I guess he had put out his written statement the day before. So he added a little background color to that about why he took the memos, et cetera. The stuff about Kushner and Sessions I didn't recall seeing in the written statement. So it was more filling in the details of the statement that he had issued the day before that I found interesting.
Mm-hmm. I'm talking to John Malcolm, who's doing an excellent job this morning of combing down the host. We'll take a short break and be right back. 15 minutes until the top of the hour. Bill Arnold here with John Malcolm. We're talking about the trial yesterday, or the hearing with James Comey. And John, here in my home state of Minnesota, there are a couple of remarks from some of the senators here. Amy Klobuchar said that Comey's testimony made it clear that President Trump had fired him because of the investigation into Russian interference with the election. Senator Al Franken released a statement saying that President Trump tried to undermine the Russian investigation. Your thoughts on that?
Well, Comey said that the reason that he said that was apparently based on some tweet that the president had done, and that was the sole source of his information. I don't recall that tweet, although I'm not doubting Director Comey on that point. So that was the source of his information, and it wasn't based on anything other than that. And all Comey said was, look, getting rid of the director could change the course or the way an investigation is conducted. I suppose that's true. Individuals are different, but he also made it very, very clear that Bob Mueller is a thorough, a competent, a professional individual, and that he had complete faith in him. Firing somebody in a politically charged environment, if your goal is to try to impede an investigation, tends not to work very well. If anything, the investigation proceeds on steroids, which is, I think, what's going to happen here.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the Democrats still want to push for impeachment, or do you think that's starting to calm down?
Well, I think they want to do everything that they can, putting on my political hat, to drive up the president's negatives because they want to frustrate his agenda and they want to do as well as they can in the midterm elections next year. Impeachment is more of a political process than a legal process. They're going to keep calling for it because it's going to drive up the president's negatives. The odds of it happening are extremely small. Under the Constitution, you need a majority of the House of Representatives to approve articles of impeachment. The Democrats do not control the House of Representatives. Perhaps after next year's midterm election, they might, which might change the calculus there. In order to convict the president and throw him out of office, you need to get two-thirds of the Senate. They do not control the Senate. It is unlikely that they will control the Senate after the next election. So the odds of the president actually being convicted of charges of impeachment I consider to be exceedingly remote unless some major smoking gun comes out or he becomes so unpopular that, you know, his negatives as high as his negatives are now, they would have to be much, much higher before I think people would really abandon ship on him and actually throw him out of office. I think we're a long, long way from that. I don't think we'll ever get there, but that doesn't mean that people like this congressman in Texas. I think his name's Al Green, aren't going to push for it.
John, if you have your crystal ball in your office, would you glance that direction and tell us what might what might happen next?
Well, it's fractured and had to be taped up quite a bit. But I, you know, I
I'll do the jokes, John.
Okay, I'll stay in my lane. I think that look, this is going to continue. Bob Mueller's going to do his thing. I mean, one of the bad things from the president's perspective about a special counsel is he doesn't feel in any great rush to do anything, and he won't. He's not going to go away anywhere. So this issue is going to be around, and the Democrats are going to continue to make political hay of it. They're going to add that to the panoply of things that they think the president is doing wrong, both substantively and in terms of his style. And so they're going to try to use this against him. I mean, you saw, you're hearing what Amy Klobuchar has to say, and you heard Mark Warner, who's the ranking member on that committee, who gave his statement, sort of stringing together a whole bunch of disparate facts and trying to draw inferences from them that I think are a bit of a stretch. But that's going to be part of their narrative. At the moment, it is a political narrative designed to drive the president's negatives up to frustrate his agenda. If they retake control of the House, then, you know, perhaps it moves into the quasi-legal realm of impeachment proceedings. But I don't see that happening, at least not anytime soon.
Mm-hmm. John, how do you think we start to restore respect for the rule of law in our country?
Boy, that's a tough one. I suppose before you begin to restore respect for the rule of law, you have to begin by restoring respect that we have for each other in terms of our diversity of opinions. Yeah, well, that is a harder thing. But I think you need to get a little bit down that road before you can start talking about respect for the rule of law. So it depends on what you mean by the rule of law. For me, an important thing is to get what I would refer to as constitutionalist judges onto the bench. The president has a remarkable opportunity in that there are a number of vacancies on the lower federal courts. He's now nominated. He just had a slew of nominations the other day. There are still a lot of vacancies. He's got something like 15 nominees. There are 129 vacancies and several more in the pipeline of judges who have announced that in the near future they will be retiring, filling those positions with judges who stay in their very important but narrow lanes in terms of interpreting the Constitution and interpreting statutes. And getting some good court rulings, I think, will go a long way towards rebalancing the courts, at least with respect to the rule of law.
Mm-hmm. So James Comey, 6'8", unemployed guy, maybe a high school basketball coach coming up next for him. I don't know. But who's going to replace him? What do you think of Ray as the new FBI director?
Well, I know Chris Wray. I've known him for a long time. I think incredibly highly of Chris Wray. So Chris went to Yale College, Yale Law School. He then clerked for Michael Luttig on the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals. Michael Luttig was an incredibly highly respected conservative judge. He's now the general counsel at Boeing. After he finished his clerkship, his wife was from Atlanta. They moved to Atlanta, which is where I was practicing law at the time. So he was at King & Spalding, a very prestigious law firm, where he did white-collar criminal defense work under Griffin Bell, who had been Jimmy Carter's attorney general. I was a federal prosecutor in Atlanta at the time. I left the office at the beginning of 1997. Chris Wray came in like within a month or two after me, so we just missed overlapping there. But while I was in Atlanta, I knew a ton of defense attorneys, prosecutors, agents who thought the world of Chris Wray. After George W. Bush won, Chris and I both went to Washington. He served as the principal deputy to Larry Thompson, who was the deputy attorney general. I was a deputy in the criminal division. I dealt with Chris a lot in that capacity. And after 2 years, when the head of the criminal division at the time, Mike Chertoff, left to become a judge, Chris became the head of the criminal division. So he was my boss, and I was a deputy under him for about 10 months. I thought very highly of the guy, principled, dedicated, hardworking, nonpartisan in his approach to things, thought he did a superb job. I then left. He stayed on for another year. When he left, he received every accolade that the department could give him. And since then, he has done an outstanding job as the head of the special matters section back at his old firm of King & Spalding. I think he will be a superb FBI director. He knows the Department of Justice incredibly well, having been everything from a line attorney to the head of the criminal division. He's worked with FBI agents on investigations when he was a prosecutor, and in a post-9/11 world, he worked on a daily basis with the FBI and the deputy who replaced Larry Thompson, which, and those two people are Bob Mueller and Jim Comey. So he knows the FBI in and out, is highly regarded, and ought to be unanimously confirmed, although, of course, he won't be in this political environment.
John, will the Bridgegate episode hurt him at all? I know he was involved with that.
Well, you know, he was involved with that in the sense that he represented Chris Christie. That's hardly surprising. Chris Christie was a U.S. attorney in New Jersey at the time that Chris was at the Department of Justice. He needed good representation, and he sure got it. Boy, I suppose that the Democrats will try to make some hay out of that. The only thing I would say about the quote-unquote Bridgegate scandal and his representation of Chris Christie is that he did a darn good job, because Chris Christie didn't end up getting charged with anything, and that's the job of a good defense attorney, and everybody is entitled to zealous representation, including Governor Christie.
Yeah.
But, you know, look, if you're going to start holding against – it certainly won't be the first time that somebody has tried to hold against an attorney something about the person whom he represented.
John, you did an excellent job today of not making me feel nervous. Thank you.
I'm very glad.
And next time you come on the air, I'd like to spend 45 minutes talking about your kids.
All right. Sounds
all right,
great.
Thanks.
Have some golf. Good to be with you.
Have a great day. All right. A couple minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back in just a minute. All right. A couple minutes till the top of the hour. What a fascinating conversation I had with John Malcolm. You know, when I was a kid, reading and comprehension was not – I was not good at that. And now as I get older, listening and comprehension is my problem. So, I mean, he gave us so much information. I have to go back and listen to it myself just so I can take it all in. But Adam Holtz is up next. We're going to talk about entertainment coming up for the weekend movies and what we need to pay attention to and what we need to avoid as best we can and why. So we'll talk to Adam just in a few minutes. Be back in –
Thank you for listening to this conversation from Faith Radio Mornings. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make your gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and growing the impact of Faith Radio Mornings. Also, take a moment to subscribe to this podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a show.